You're listening to a download from the outdoorstation.co.uk.
Number 330.
Welcome to part 6, which is the final podcast in the Channel Island Way series, sponsored by visitguernsey.com and based upon the guide The Channel Island Way, published in 2011 by Coast Media. The book links together all the coastal walks around the islands of Alderney, Guernsey, Herm, Jersey and Sark to create a continual 110-mile route. We were invited by Visit Guernsey to walk sections of the guide and produce a series of podcasts about the journey, the islands and some of the people we met en route. You join us now on Guernsey at Les Vaugrats campsite, where we discovered one evening that the owners, John and Peggy Lenné, had been evacuees during the Second World War, sent off as young children with a single suitcase and separated at a very tender age from their loved ones and their childhood home.
Living in this house 60 years this year. Up to the age of 10, I lived next door down the road where I was born. And because of the war, we were youngsters evacuated to England, where we stayed for 5 years. The family moved over there, except for father, who stayed next door during the German occupation. And we were five kids and mum, and stayed in different parts of the north of England, Cheshire, Lancashire, Wales, Derbyshire.
Oh, so you were split up then during the war, were you?
All split up, all different places. Yeah, and I had an identical twin brother. We stayed together for a year and then I moved to one school, a local Guernsey school, and he went to another one.
And how was that during your childhood to do that during the occupation? How did it feel from a family point of view?
Well, it was an experience. I don't think we worried too much about the family aspect of it, because it was just an adventure at that time. And occasionally, we only saw each other as a family two or three times during the war when we got together. But most of the time, we stayed in our own corners, and I was with the family. So I was very fortunate. After 1 year, I lived with a very good family in Oldham and stayed there for the 4 years.
And I assume when the family got back together again after the war, then it was a sort of a party atmosphere, was it?
Yes and no. Well, having brothers similar ages, you see, we were playing football and cricket and all these things, whereas we hadn't had it with the family. I played these different games, etc., away, usually against the cemetery gates or somewhere like that. But no, it was quite different coming back together, and it seemed almost as if we hadn't missed. Some people had great difficulty settling down again, but we just continued. My father always used to put it, "I've lost 5 years of my life," because that was our formative years from 10 to 15.
Mm. Mm. And was it the same for you, Peggy?
No, totally different. My father died in 39, and we were just living a normal life, you know, back in our home, and we evacuated. My sister and my mother went with the Vale School. We went to Wigan. My grandmother and grandfather and my mother's brother and sister and their partners evacuated, and they finished up in Coventry because there was work. So after 2 weeks in Wigan, at the same time as Junt School, the schools went to Cheshire and we went down to Coventry. And after the Blitz, we rented the house next door and we were a complete family. My grandmother did the cooking. My sister and I went to school and the others went to work. So it was just a completely different story to John's.
Was it the same sort of age? Was it sort of 10 years?
Yes.
And so did you feel that you were missing out anything at all by being away from home?
No, because I went to the same school as my sister, a girl's. Well, now it would be a grammar school. Mm-hmm. And in 45, my sister started training college. So my mother in Coventry was earning good money. So we stayed there till 47. And on her first term at work, her last term at training college, we came to Guernsey. And actually, she got a job at our old school in Guernsey, along with John's sister. Yeah, right. Who finished her teacher training.
Did you feel that the whole experience, the pair of you, that actually took you away from, obviously, a small island? Did it actually develop your skills and experiences?
It was just part of life.
Yeah.
I mean, you took it for granted during the war. Everybody was doing something different. Mm. And then sort of after the war, my grandparents came back in the October and their house was exactly as they left it, but we'd lost our home.
In what way? Physically, it destroyed or...?
Well, no, all the furniture had vanished.
Oh, I see.
You know, sort of my mother was in rent and all our furniture vanished and goods, you know, and all the knick-knacks you have in a home. There was nothing left and that was it. But we all took it as life.
It was very rare for anybody in those early war years then to go to England. And so it was quite an experience. We'd heard the rumour that we were going to Canada, which would have been very nice. Anyhow, we went to England, to the north of England, and it widened our experience of life, if you like, and all the different things. See, the experience for us was seeing trains, double-decker buses, black and white cows, sheep.
And sheep, yeah.
All sorts of things like that we didn't see locally. Well, sheep you could see locally if you knew where to go and look. But most of the things were all new and quite exciting for us, you know.
So do you think there was a generation then at that time that when they came back after the war brought some new way of thinking with them?
Certainly. I think a lot of people, you know, their experiences in different parts of the country, and people are still telling of their experiences during the war years. And everybody had a story to tell, whether they were in Guernsey, whether they were in England or anywhere else, even prison camps, they have a story to tell about that time. Which is, well, we find it very interesting, having been involved. Mm. But, no, it's good. It's good.
So did the family then develop, go into growing when they came back? Or how did that all sort of come about?
Well, most people, as you're aware, were growers. My father was a grower. And the family had been for generations and farmers. So it just continued with the growing business. And after a year at school back in Guernsey, my twin brother and I went into growing. We worked with Dad for about a year or two, and then we went on our own growing outside tomatoes, bulbs, potatoes, and that sort of thing, just to make a bit of a bob, if you like.
Was it commercially? Was it supplying a local market, or were you sort of selling further afield at that stage?
Well, we always exported flowers and that sort of thing.
And tomatoes.
So that was where the market was. And those early years after the war was quite beneficial for people. And the growing was the business really to get into. Finance industry and those things hadn't come yet. Mm. So you looked to do what the family had done for generations.
And was that the same for you as well, Peggy?
No. My grandparents were growers.
Right.
And after the war, we sort of settled with them. And then my mother built a house about 10 minutes away from my grandparents. And she went to work in town. And then I was working in town. Then I met you at the youth club. Eh? Mm. And we sort of got married and that was it.
So you were, am I right in thinking, 21 when you got married, did you say?
21, yeah.
Nearly 21.
21.
Well, congratulations to you both on that score, certainly. So when did the growing then change into camping? How did that come about?
Well, in 1978, 76 or 78, was it?
In the North Sea.
Yeah, 78, I think, when we had the energy crisis at that time, the price of oil got very prohibitive. And for a year or two, we tried growing cold in the greenhouses. Of course, we used to produce tomatoes in February at that time with heat, but we couldn't afford to pay the price of fuel as anybody, nobody else could.
What finished the industry was when the oil sea gas came and the Dutch had cheap fuel.
Yeah.
They had the North Sea gas that was cheap, but we had to pay for the oil, which was very dear.
Top whack.
And they took over the English market, really.
Yeah, that's quite so, yeah.
So when did the growing activity decline then and change into camping?
Well, when it hit the bottom, really, was I think it was 1978, and then we started to think what we're going to do. And we decided that we'll utilise our land and start camping, I was well-versed in camping because I was in the Scout movement and had been training men and boys for years in Scout craft and camping in particular. It was slow growing the first year, but by the second year, we were having to live off it, because the growing had then really finished. And so we had to rely entirely on that, so we built it up gradually from that stage onwards.
And have you seen a great change in the type of people you call campers over the last 33 years?
Yes, a lot, really. Yeah. Now, the people who come camping are the ones who enjoy camping, and they're more easygoing. I mean, the last month, the boats were upside down because they were broken, and the campers were arriving late. The weather wasn't all that good, and some of them had awful rough journeys, but they never complained. When we first started, if that had happened, they would have been in uproar about it. Eh? But I think campers must be true campers of easygoing.
Yeah, so
have you found that out?
Well, they're much more easygoing now than years before. I suppose they didn't have an option beforehand. No. That was the only holiday they'd have.
They're camping now because they enjoy the outdoor life. And the atmosphere of the camping.
The facilities you've got here are lovely, lovely. I mean, what looks simple, but very clean, very nice, and exactly what people want. Do people sort of...
That's my scouting experience, you see. We knew what was the most important thing in a camp is good facility.
Do people sort of expect or ask for any more than that?
No, I don't think so.
70% is return visits. You know, so...
Well, actually, how many tents or how many people are you licensed to have then? How does it work?
Well, 150 sites, but we've added two fields since we had that permission. We've never asked for more, but we never get to 150.
And we never count, do we?
Seldom count now.
Yeah. We never put the tents close together.
Well, that's an important part of it. People like the space, don't they?
And up the other side of the shop.
We've got two more fields.
We put couples there with the smaller tents and no children.
Right.
And they like that, eh?
Yeah, really, mainly continental go up there, the backpackers, we always call them, and some go up there and some down there, you know, if they want to shower, they all go up there. So it's well spread out and they can all take in the flowers and the view.
Well, certainly I'd like to congratulate you on the campsite. It's a glorious display of colour today as we've arrived, and everything is just perfect from our point of view.
Well, it's bound to be perfect with a day like it is today. The weather is spot on. You know, we want this for the rest of the summer.
And how many actual campsites are there on Guernsey itself? Because I'm a bit confused over that. Because it's very, very restrictive, isn't it? It's very controlled.
Yeah. There's only two campsites operating at the moment, Fouquet Valley and ourselves.
But in the meantime, this is the best one around.
Well, it always has been the best.
You're listening to The Outdoor Station.
Award-winning producers of podcasts to inform, inspire, entertain, and encourage people to enjoy a healthy outdoors lifestyle.
It was an early start this morning to catch the flight from Guernsey to Alderney via Oringi Airlines. I think that's the correct way of pronouncing it. And we arrived here about 8 o'clock. The heart of Alderney is, well, back to that comment that was made earlier on, every island has its own character. And certainly the heart of Alderney was not what we were expecting. I suppose we were comparing it in some ways to Sark, but because the roads are paved and cobblestoned, and there is much more of a heart to the village itself, it's quite a little hive of activity.
Yeah, it's much more of sort of a village feel, a larger village feel. The houses, you know, it's Victorian terraced houses and a cobbled street, the main street, very attractive.
Certainly with all the facilities, a good handful of shops, banks with cash points, which is obviously definitely one step above Sark. and very nicely appointed hotel. We went to the hotel for breakfast, and that was very nice, overlooking the bay. So we set out on the walk as per the Channel Island Way book, and we've now done probably about an eighth of it, where we've come round to the island called Les Attaques, or Garden Rocks, which is where it is home to 7,000 breeding pairs of northern gannets, apparently. You can probably hear, if I just stay quiet for a second or two, you can hear a skylark in the background in the little valley where we're standing. And then literally a couple hundred metres away from me is this rock covered in gannets and gannet guano and standing out like a sore thumb. This is the noise they're making. It sounds like some sort of distant machinery, but it's a real clatter as you get closer.
It's quite a surreal sight too, as you come round the corner to see the snow-white rock, because obviously with the white of the gannets and the white of the guano, it looks like something unreal, and then obviously they're all nesting on the rock as well as swirling round it. It's quite eerie.
The path itself is fairly easy going. There's a few occasional steep climbs, and we're about to do one now out of this valley. But I'd say it's akin to walking across, you know, sort of common land, really.
Yeah, it's the path's definitely less trodden. I think it's Alderney, because you have to want to come here. I think it's a bit more difficult to get to.
Yes, it's not so easy to follow underfoot, but it's still relatively clear. And let's face it, you're on a small island. You can't really get lost. So, here's a plane going over, taking off from Alderney Airport. Alderney International Airport. I see it's got all the modern signs. As you can tell, they're all prop planes. There's nothing big and elaborate as jets here. We spoke to Joanna this morning from Alderney Tourist Information, who told us quite a bit about the local history of Alderney, and certainly we hope to catch up with her later on today and to fill us all in with a bit more detail. But already we've passed one of the concentration camps, which I never realised Alderney was home to, and from what she was saying this morning, there were several of them. So we will learn a bit more history as we go along. So we're going to carry on now along the route according to the book and work our way a bit further around the island, heading north now to come back around to the north side of St Anne, which is the sort of the town, the village, the centre, the capital, and then we'll fill you in a bit more a bit later on. About 4.5 hours after we started, we are probably three quarters of the way around, perhaps slightly less. We've gone past Bray Bay and Fort Albert, and we're now sitting at Corblett Bay. We stopped for lunch at the harbour, and there's a little cafe there, had a snack, and we've taken our time walking, taking photographs, a bit of video, and just enjoying the scenery and the day. It has been superb walking. Fairly easy, gentle, undulating, and very, very few people around.
We've only used the poles once on one fairly steep ascent. We put them away on this section of the island. It's just lovely, easy walking. Lots of wildflowers and butterflies and birds. Fantastic bays. Nobody on the lovely sandy beaches. It's just glorious.
Yes, the beaches could have come straight from the Caribbean. They're just white sand, very, very fine, and as Rose says, completely empty. Walk through the campsite. I don't know how many tents it'll take, but the campsite's just tucked behind the dunes, right beside the sea. A beautiful place for children. And we're reliably informed there's over 50 miles of paths to walk on the island, although the circumnavigation we're doing is about 11 and a half miles, and we'll probably do pretty well 90% of it. Only just because there's a convenient stopping and starting point. But certainly plenty to look at, and certainly a lovely island if peace and tranquility is your thing.
The sea looks so inviting. We actually swam yesterday, didn't we? And the sea is so clear, Apparently it's to do with the fact that most of the sand is from the granite rocks, so it's heavy, so the particles actually stay on the bottom, because it's just turquoise. It's gorgeous.
We've spoken to a couple we met at the cafe at the harbour, who is a podcast fan, coincidentally, and they're here for 2 weeks with their dogs, and they seem to have plenty of things to do, photography and a bit of fishing, and then saying how much they enjoy the tranquility of the place. So we're going to have a rest now for 5 minutes or so, and then we'll pop on our little day packs. Rose has got the little Go Light
VO24.
Thank you. And I've got the Race Elite 25 Innovate, which contains everything we need. Supposedly there was going to be a thunderstorm today, which it hasn't happened just yet. So we're just carrying some basic clothes, and we will soon get back into St Anne's, where we'll meet up with Joanna again and hopefully have a coffee and find out a little bit more about the history. It's the fortifications of the island which have come as quite a shock, only because every turning, every corner, there is either Victorian or German defences. And if you've got to look where you're going, because it's very easy to step into trenches, gun batteries, various observation holes, access points. The amount of concrete that's on this island is defending the island is very impressive, but also quite frightening. So it must have been quite an important military point, obviously during World War II and before.
Any time, any place, anywhere.
This is the Outdoor Station. A million listeners worldwide can't be wrong.
It's all about the great outdoors.
We completed the circumnavigation around Alderney in a very leisurely 5 hours, stopping on many occasions to admire the view, explore a few of the seemingly endless German fortifications, walk barefoot on the glorious sandy beaches, watch the wildlife, and enjoy refreshments whenever we came across them. At the end of the day, we met up with Joanna Parmentier once again, who is the PR and marketing manager for Alderney. And I was curious to know what type of visitor gets the most from such a unique place.
Certainly those who appreciate lifestyle. Alderney's very relaxed and easygoing, and I think it's a great escape for people. Special interest visitors, those with a particular interest who want to come here to do something particularly like fishing. We have great fishing here. Those who appreciate history and heritage, and wildlife. We have some fantastic wildlife. Also young affluent families.
Are you busy all year round? Because presumably the weather's fairly kind to you here.
The season's mostly from April to September. The busiest months are June, July and August. September is a really busy month for events. We have golf competitions, half marathons, air races and the Alderney annual hill climb.
The visitor that you get presumably from mainland Guernsey, do you get a lot of people that sort of visit for a day or do they stay for a short while?
From Guernsey, they vary from day trippers to people staying for longer as part of a two-centre holiday. Otherwise, we get a lot of people who fly directly from Southampton here and they'll stay for a longer period of time and they're only coming to Alderney.
We spoke to somebody down at the harbour today that specifically came here and they've come for 2 weeks and they're staying down at the campsite. And they were really looking forward to literally switching off and slowing down. Would they be a typical family visitor?
Absolutely. Yeah, those people who really want to get away from it, really want a relaxing and peaceful time. You know, there's no traffic here, there's no massive queues, everything's within easy walking distance. Most people are very friendly. And it's just a really relaxing experience for people.
The wildlife is obviously one of the main attractions here. Tell me a bit more about that.
Alderney is quite big on seabirds in particular. We've got two gannet trees with 7,000 pairs of gannets between them. One of them is arguably one of those most easiest viewed gannet trees in Europe, and they're northern gannets. We've got breeding puffins, 200 pairs, grey Atlantic seals and blonde hedgehogs. Which, as far as I'm aware, I don't know of any other breeding populations of them.
From experience today, we've heard the gannets from the shore, but I presume there's a boat trip or whatever that gets you closer.
There is. There's a boat trip, and it takes you around the island, but on its way, it takes you to see the seals. You go past Buru, which is where the puffins are breeding. There's also storm petrels, cormorants and shags and all sorts of other seabirds. You visit both of the gannet trees, and then you take a tour around the rest of the island, taking in all the Victorian forts, but from the seascape as opposed to land, and they're very different.
That was one thing that struck us today as we've been round, is just how fortified the island has been over the years. And obviously there's two types of era that the fortifications were built. Can you give us a bit more information on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was the Romans were here, and they had a harbour at Longy. And then we've had the Victorians. They had 13 forts that they built, and Queen Victoria wanted to house the home the British fleet here. So they brought our massive seawall known as the Breakwater, and it was going to have another arm, but they ran out of money. And then the most significant second period was during the Second World War, when Alderney was completely evacuated, apart from 8 people who stayed, and totally occupied by the German forces.
Two questions there. What happened to the 8 people that stayed?
They were still here after the war, as far as I'm aware. One of them was a farmer, and he refused to leave. So they just stayed and lived amongst the Germans. But I think they were kept very separate from a lot of things that were going on, because there were 3 forced labour camps here. So there were a lot of prisoners of war and a lot of things that went on.
I noticed there were some pillars from one of the labour camps. Are they documented anywhere?
They are, yes. The pillars still exist on the island in all 3 places, and they are documented in our literature, and also in the museum leaflets, talking about the Victorian era and the German occupation. Yeah.
The Germans certainly dug themselves in well, didn't they?
They did. I mean, one thing they certainly left behind was plenty of concrete. It's everywhere. There's not very far that you can walk in Alderney without stumbling across or into, you know, upon a bunker. Most of them are obviously underground, but there is one in particular known as the Odeon, because it used to look like an old Odeon cinema, that's prominent, and it's quite a significant landmark.
The town itself is quite sweet and cobblestoned, and it certainly seems to be the centre of all the activities, unlike Sark, which is sort of dotted around and spread around the island. All the roads lead to St Anne's.
Yes, I mean, St Anne's is the main town. It's just literally the one street. But most of the shops and everything that you need is there. The other hub is at the harbour, starting to have a lot more activity there as well, because obviously a lot of the visiting yachtsmen come in, and so they need servicing and don't necessarily want to take the walk up the hill. But, St Anne's is very pretty. And we've got our church, which is known as the Cathedral of the Channel Islands.
There's a rail link, or some rail tracks down by the harbour there. Is that still running?
Yes, we've got the only running railway in the Channel Islands. It actually has some carriages from the Northern Line on there, which is pulled by our train. And it takes visitors backwards and forwards along the line, which takes you on a scenic route along the coast. And that runs on the weekends by volunteers. And it was originally put in place by the Victorians to quarry stone to build the breakwater.
Tell me about the island generally. What sort of population do you have normally, and what does it expand to? And I'm curious to know what it's like to live here.
The island itself is 1 mile by 3, and it's 7 miles square. It's got about 2,000 population. There's a number of houses that are owned by second homeowners. So in the summer, and at Christmas and Easter, then it's busier here. The busiest time of year is Alderney Week, which is a week-long festival. And the population near enough doubles during that week, all the hotels, campsites full. And it's really a week for the family, and there's lots and lots going on every single day. Living here, it's a great place to live, actually. It's fantastic in the summer. It's a little bit harder in the winter, obviously, but I think it is anywhere. But we've got good links to the UK, and we've got good links to Guernsey, so it's never too difficult to get off for a few days, but no, it's a nice place to live.
As we've been walking around, we've seen various stones, which we understand Andy Goldsworthy has been responsible for.
Yes, that's correct. He came a year or so ago, and he built the stones. There's 11 of them in total. And then he brought them out in April and put them into place. And the idea is there's 11 all in different areas that he's chosen in particular. And each one of them has something inside. So I think some of them have got seeds, some of them have got gloves. They're all things that he's found around the coastline, so things off of the beaches. And the idea is he's put them in different places to see how they're going to erode and be shaped by nature, basically, which he thought was significant for Alderney.
And has it attracted any interest?
There's certainly been a lot of interest. I think he's very popular in America, so there's been interest there. And also he's quite a big following in the UK. where they've only been into place in April, and we know that we've had people visiting as a result of them, but we're hoping that there's going to be a lot more.
On that note, how easy is it to get here?
It's very easy, actually. I mean, you can travel direct from, you can fly direct from Southampton, and that service very well by the train. So it's literally, you get off at the airport, over the footbridge, and you're in the airport, and it's not a busy airport, so it's quite quick. There's also, you can fly via Guernsey from either with Orini that fly from Manchester or East Midlands and a number of other national airports, or with Flybe from Birmingham and Exeter and other places. Otherwise, there is a ferry, but it only goes from France, from Dillette, and that goes a couple of times a month, and that brings our French visitors to us.
Yeah, I mean, proportionally, how many French visitors to UK visitors do you get?
We get 70% UK visitors, and then the rest would be French, and we also get some Dutch as well.
Some of the beaches we've seen today are absolutely stunning. You would think they could be found in the Caribbean. They've been towed across.
That's true. I mean, I've been travelling, and I've failed or have struggled to find beaches as good as ours. I have found a few, but they are stunning. They're small in size, so they're not massive stretches of sand, but they're white sandy beaches with beautiful clear water. A little bit cold, but stunning to look at, and there's plenty of them as well. And what's great is they just don't get crowded in the summer, so you really, you know, you're not fighting for somewhere to put your towel. And there's beaches for all sorts. You can surf here. There's some beaches with fantastic rock pooling, and then beaches that are just great for swimming, and then others for sunbathing because they're very well sheltered, and no matter whatever the wind direction is.
And I noticed one of the nicest beaches is right next door to the campsite.
Yes, absolutely. Our campsite is literally a stone's throw from the beach. You literally just hop over the sand dunes and there you are. So an early morning swim takes about 15 minutes and then you can be back in ready for a shower. No, it's a fantastic little campsite. It really is. And people love staying there. We get some great feedback about the location of our campsite. There's also another range of, quite an extensive range of accommodation. We have a number of small hotels, guest houses, and quite an extensive range of self-catering scattered all over the island. So there's plenty of choice.
On returning from Alderney on our short little flight in yesterday in a very, very small plane, which was extremely exciting, it was a time for reflection, really, and just recognising just what a treasure the Channel Islands are, and in particular Herm, Sark and Alderney. There's a certain timelessness and fortitude about the islands which makes them very, very unique and something that needs to be celebrated, I think, and maintained for as long as possible. There's a ruggedness to them. The landscape is rich and varied. The walking, from a walker's point of view, is not difficult, but there's plenty there to interest people, whether it's wildlife or nature or just general peace and quiet.
Around every corner there is some element to remind you to of the rich history that has been in these islands from sort of Neolithic right through to, you know, the German occupation and more currently. So I think there really is lots to keep you entertained and interested in these islands. But above all, I think what will remain with me is just how beautiful they are.
Certainly, there is a timeless beauty to them, and an elegance and a pace of life, which is also good to be treasured as well. There's a slowness, a grace to them, which is something very pleasing when you come away from mainland UK. It's certainly been an interesting trip, an enjoyable trip, and a very informative trip. The Channel Islands generally is something where that I've always wanted to visit, and Sark in particular, for some reason, has been ingrained in my mind as a place to visit, and I certainly would recommend all of the islands without hesitation. Sadly, on this particular trip, we don't have time to include Jersey, although that is in fact in the Channel Island Way book. But it's our last day today, and this afternoon we have one last adventure, which is to do a little bit of sea kayaking. So we look forward to sharing that with you a bit later on.
We packed our belongings once again into our little jam packs and returned to Petit Beau Bay to meet up with Anthony Ford Parker, owner of Outdoor Guernsey. The weather was just perfect for spending time by the sea. Patchy warm sunshine, a slight breeze, rolling white clouds beneath a deep blue sky, as Anthony set us up with sea kayaks for a paddle around the headland.
Well, thanks very much for taking us out today. It's been an enjoyable experience, short and sweet, but extremely interesting seeing the coastline from a completely different viewpoint.
Yeah, the very enjoyable conditions, not totally flat calm, which is nice to get out in those kind of conditions with somebody that actually knows what they're doing, a nice paddle with other paddlers. That was very enjoyable for me too.
Now, you were just saying to Rose that sit-on kayaks have grown in interest in recent years. Why is that?
We were just discussing why there's so many of those sit-on tops around, and I think it's people have always been scared of being trapped inside a sit-in kayak. The general public, we that paddle, know that they're actually comfy and you can do much more with them. But sit-on kayaks have opened it up to a lot more people that don't want to be
proper, trapped or feel that they're trapped.
And proper paddlers, as they look at it, they're more recreational paddlers. Take the kids out in good conditions around the coast and get to see some of this, which, you know, I think that's a great thing, you know, that people can actually now have got the confidence with these sit-on tops to actually get out and see it, because it shouldn't be the domain of just the elitist few, that are prepared to put on neoprene and you know, go and launch themselves into the surf. There's a lot of stuff out there for everybody to see.
Well, certainly as we set off today, I saw several sort of, I'd say, family groups, father and sons coming in, and they looked like they had a great time.
Yeah, they were having a great time, weren't they? Yeah, kids sat in the front of the boat and dad's mum in the back of the boat, and it was difficult to tell who was having the most fun, really, wasn't it?
I suppose at least if kids dive off and they want to, they can get back into the sit-ons much easier than worrying about, as you say, sit-ins.
It's true. That is the main thing. And whether it's, you know, in people's heads or whatever, it is true that you can get back on these boats much easier. So yeah, the kids can just launch themselves into the water, swim along and go and explore a cave, and, you know, back on the boat afterwards. Yeah,
you've been doing this now for a few years, and certainly looking on the back of the trailers here, we've got 12 boats here on the back of the trailer. That's quite a collection. How's it changed over the years? Have people become more adventurous, do you think, seeing sort of the more outdoor programmes on TV? Has there been a particular time that there's been a vast amount of interest in actually paddling generally?
From the paddling perspective, since we started using sit-on tops and introducing people, you know, on our what we call our explorations, we've seen a big boom in the number of sit-on tops on the water. I never used to see other kayaks on the water unless it was with other paddlers I knew. Everybody that had a kayak on their roof on the island, I knew. I waved to them as I went past. Now everybody's got a boat on the roof of their car. So that's changed dramatically in the last 2 or 3 years. That's a massive change. There are some good programs around about getting out in the outdoors. I think people are confident to do that now as families, you know, from quite a young age, and even 50, 60 year olds nowadays seem to be a lot fitter and you know, more up for getting involved with the outdoors than they used to be.
That's a good thing, isn't it? Good thing. Talk about confidence. I know you do coasteering as well, and that's had a sudden growth, hasn't it, in the last 12 months or so?
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier, weren't we? The coasteering for us is rapidly catching up with the kayaking. People were a bit wary at first because they didn't quite know what we were up to. They thought we were just jumping off cliffs. But the more people we've taken out, word's got round that actually we're exploring a really quite a fantastic environment out there. So it's not just about jumping off cliffs. It's a lot of other things too.
Perhaps for people who are listening to this and not very aware of what coasteering is, describe what a family group might go through if you took them out for an afternoon.
Okay, well, we get kitted up in wetsuits and boots and helmets and buoyancy aids, so it's quite easy from there on. There's no other kit, there's no kayak or paddle or anything like that. It's just you and some protective gear, and we go traversing around the coastline and exploring, basically, at sea level. Maybe sometimes just above it, sometimes maybe just a little bit below it, you know. But it's basically at sea level, exploring the coastline. Pools, caves, gullies, whatever.
And what type of person gets the most from that?
Type of person? Wow, well, they've all got a similar mindset. They're all up for having a go and and appreciating the outdoors and the whole experience. And there is a certain glint in their eye while they're doing it, and a certain recognition that they've done something particularly special when they come back, and they keep coming back as well. So
Well, that's a good thing. I mean, certainly the waters around the islands here, and Guernsey in particular, are wonderfully clear, and obviously it has the same sort of tidal issues that any island would have, but it must make it an ideal location for doing water sports generally, but in particular kayaking.
Well, with this huge tidal range, we've got 10 meters, 30 feet tidal range. It means that every time you go out, it's slightly different, and it changes really, really quickly. So to get the breadth of experience to really understand and know what's going on the whole time, you've got to spend a long, long time doing it, you know, which gives people a lot of scope for variety. So, you know, the families that are going out, they're not doing the same thing every time. They're very unlikely to do the same thing every time. You know, variety, and with it being such a small island as well, you know, stacks of variety for people.
The four coasts of the island, as it were, are quite different characters, aren't they? I mean, you've got we're on the south coast at the moment, and it's very craggy, very rocky, but obviously around the north and around the west coast, it looks calmer, but you're saying it's more challenging paddling conditions.
Yeah, you've got the views here on the south and the east. On the west, you've got views of beaches, which is quite nice too, and some lovely shallow areas where the tide goes out a long way, and you can see a lot of sea life. We had one guy who just picked up a spider crab the other week, and he just leant out of his kayak and picked it up, and he was a keeper as well. We put it back, but it, you know, it was a big spider crab. But you see these sort of things wandering around all over the place, you know. And then on the north coast, it's those challenging conditions, real fast-moving tides in between all the little islets and the overfalls. And so if you want some exciting paddling, you know, that's the place to head for.
Well, certainly looking at you, you're tanned, you're fit, you're healthy, you've got a smile on your face and not a worried wrinkle. So it's a bit of a tough job, I think, all in all.
Yeah, I've got a few wrinkles, though, but they're not from worry. So it's just old age now. But, yeah, no, it's fantastic life, isn't it? And who wouldn't want to be out there all the time if they could do it? But for me, it's introducing people to it and seeing the growth in it is what I like about it. That's what I get take away from my job, is seeing people that I've taken out paddling or coasteering, and actually I see them out independently on their own, you know, and that's gratifying to me, because I know how brilliant it is out there, and now they know.
My thanks to everyone involved in this, the final episode of the Channel Island Way series, and to the sponsor, visitguernsey.com. More information about the Channel Islands can, of course, be found on the website, should this series inspire you to try somewhere different for a long or short break. Our guide, The Channel Island Way, is published by Channel Island map specialists Coast Media and written by Blue Badge guide Arthur Lamy. The book is available from amazon.co.uk, priced at £9.95, and in visitor centres and book retailers throughout the islands. The Channel Islands certainly have much to offer the walker, and we really enjoyed the rich variety and character each island offers. Not just glorious views, secret coves, white sands, wildlife and fishing, but a more pleasurable, relaxed approach to life. No matter which of the islands you're lucky enough to visit, you can be sure that you don't have to go far to switch off and appreciate some of the treasures which go to make up this quiet, secret little corner of the UK.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear more from our extensive free library, please visit the website at theoutdoorstation.co.uk.
You can now follow The Outdoor Station on Facebook, where we chat about each programme we produce, answer questions and discuss future productions. Why not join us there?
This podcast is produced and hosted by theoutdoorstation.co.uk.